There was you, my dear. I thought love was a game one would win or would lose until I found you. Until I found. Was a shame, so I threw it away. And then there was you.
On CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.cqut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@cqut.ca.
Listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia.
And my name is Candace.
And we're your hosts for today's show. Today we'll be joined live in the studio by Arlene Gallon and Clara Poisson-L'Espérance. Arlene is leading a class action lawsuit against the Correctional Services Canada for placing her in long-term solitary confinement during her imprisonment in the Federal Prison for Women in Joliet, Quebec. Clara is her lawyer. On va faire l'entrevue un peu en français et un peu en anglais. We will then be airing an interview with Muti Ajamu Osogboro of Juveniles R Us, an organization which focuses on children who have been falsely imprisoned. Later on in the hour, we'll be joined on the phone by Kim Pate, the executive director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies, and a newly appointed Canadian senator who will be speaking with us about her November 2016 Senate appointment. But first, some news items. Former U.S. President Obama has commuted the 35-year prison sentence of Chelsea Manning, paving the way for the Army intelligence analyst turned high-profile leaker to be freed on May 17th of this year. Manning was on a list of 209 commutations and 64 pardons released last Tuesday. Manning was convicted after leaking U.S. military incident logs and diplomatic cables, among other secret government documents, to WikiLeaks in 2010. Earlier this week, WikiLeaks said on Twitter that its founder, Julian Assange, would agree to be extradited to the United States if Obama granted clemency to Manning. Assange has been living in Ecuador's embassy in London since June 2012 to avoid extradition to Sweden, where he has been accused of sexual assault.
And the Journal de Montréal reports that inmates in penitentiaries in Quebec are more likely to end their lives than anywhere else in the country. They are also placed in solitary confinement more often than other Canadian prisoners. A report published by the Office of the Correctional Investigator established a direct link between isolation and suicide. There were nearly 200 suicides in Quebec federal penitentiaries during the last 10-year period. These deaths are tragic and preventable. Sadly, on January 15th, Daniel Marcotte, an inmate from Archambault Institution in Saint-Anne-des-Plaines, died while in custody at Archambault Institution. At the time of his death, Mr. Marcotte, 55 years old, had been serving a sentence of 4 years and 1 month for break and enter and assault with a weapon. Correctional Service Canada will review the circumstances of the death as they are mandated to do so. In similar sad news, a prisoner from a federal facility in Laval has died. Federal corrections officials will only say Philippe Joseph Malouin, aged 58, died while in their custody on January 17th. A news release says Malouin was serving time at the Federal Training Center in Laval. The release gives no details of the circumstances surrounding his death. He was serving a sentence for second-degree murder, and the Federal Training Center has both minimum and medium security inmates and houses a total of 805 prisoners. And so we're going to take a short little break here. We're going to listen to an ad, and then we're going to hear an interview. Stay tuned to Prison Radio here on CKT 90.3 FM.
ASSEC is the longest-running trans project in the city that's sex worker-centered, that uses an anti-poverty model, and that focuses on people living with HIV.
I was in between jobs. ASTEC was able to help me out with the emergency fund so I could get groceries.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, but also for so many people in the community, losing ASTEC would be completely, completely devastating.
ASTEC is an organization that has been fighting for the health and livelihood of trans communities since 1998. Every year they reach thousands of people through their services and outreach programs. Now they need your help. Please go to ASTTEQ.org to donate to ASTEC.
We are now joined live in the studio by Arlene Gallon and Clara Poisson-L'Espérance. Arlene is leading a class action lawsuit against the Correctional Services Canada for placing her in long-term solitary confinement during her imprisonment in Joliet. Clara is her lawyer. Hi, welcome to the Prison Radio Show.
Hi.
Hello.
Maybe it makes most sense for Arlene to go first. Do you want to talk about your experiences in solitary confinement and tell a bit of your story?
Well, it's like a dark hole, and they throw people in there for nothing. And my experience was not good at all.
Mm-hmm. How long ago were you in Joliet?
I was there 2 years ago.
Okay. And how did it come about that you decided to do this class action lawsuit once you got out?
Well, my lawyer, my other lawyer told me about it, that Clara wanted to do something against that. So I decided to go with it. But it's mostly so I can make a change, just to make a change for the prisoners and people that's going through what I went through, because mm-hmm. they really abused the hole for no reason.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about, were there other people who also spent lots of time in the hole when you were at Joliet?
That, I don't know. I know from my experience that I was in there more often and for longer periods of time. I can't say for anybody else, mm-hmm. because I did speak with a few people, but again, it was all the same like me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Clara, do you want to talk about how you decided to approach Arlene and start the class action?
Sure. So I've been hearing a lot about this practice at the beginning of last year, in 2015 actually, that the BCCLA took a constitutional challenge against solitary confinement. And a lot of lawyers here in Quebec were saying to me, the CSC abuses of this practice. It's not only the law, it's the way it's applied by the CSC. So there's a fault probably in the way it's applied. So by talking with lawyers that do carceral law, I understood that there was probably a systematic abuse of it. And by reading all the documents, especially about the one that are written by the ombudsman, I realized that it was a practice that was generalized and abused of. So we met with Arlene, and she was a good example of what is happening, because she spent a lot of time in there, of course too much time, and she had a strong desire to change things. And class action is mostly for to make a change. So with her strong desire and willingness to help other prisoners, we decided, both of us, to take mm-hmm. that class action.
Cool. You talked about how one of your goals for the class action is to see some change. Do you want to talk a bit about the change that you hope to see?
Well, for the prisoners to get more help instead of being thrown into a room and locked up 23 on 24, mm-hmm. it doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Clara, qu'est-ce qui s'est passé à ce point avec l'action collective, like in the courts?
Alors, le 13 janvier, l'action collective a été autorisée. Action collective, c'est comme recours collectif, c'est le même terme. Ce que ça veut dire autoriser, c'est simplement que les détenus et donc le groupe que représente Arlene Gallonde peuvent s'adresser ensemble comme groupe devant les tribunaux. Puisque c'est exceptionnel, normalement, chaque demande est individuelle. Le recours collectif demande une étape supplémentaire qui est l'autorisation pour permettre comme groupe d'agir devant les tribunaux. Et donc, Arlene a été désignée représentante de ce groupe-là. Et ça permet aussi de déterminer quelles sont les questions communes. Et les questions communes ici, c'est est-ce qu'il y a des violations de la charte et est-ce qu'il y a une faute de la part du service correctionnel? Et si oui, est-ce que les détenus peuvent avoir droit à une compensation juste et du fait d'avoir été trop longtemps et pour des mauvaises raisons, donc dans le trou là, ou en isolement cellulaire?
Okay.
Donc, pour l'instant, à l'étape de l'autorisation, c'est pas tout de suite que la faute est déterminée. La Cour a pas décidé qui a raison du service correctionnel ou des personnes incarcérées, donc le groupe. Mais ça permet d'aller de l'avant pour justement permettre que la Cour se penche sur la question. Mm-hmm.
Do either of you know if it's rare that class actions pertaining to prisoners' rights go forward in the provincial court system in Quebec? Has this happened before?
I have no clue.
Actually, it's pretty... it's not the first time. We do another lawsuit at my office regarding abusive search. But it's not a common thing. Unfortunately, because we happen to know that there is a lot of abuse practice that are abused in prison. But charter, in generally, it's not a common field for class action. And we hope we will take more and more because it's class action is a very good tool to change a practice at a big scale. Unfortunately, when a lawyer take one case, it can make an example of it. But to change one at a single time, a whole practice, it takes either political willingness or class action.
Mm-hmm. So you both have been working on this class action for about a year now?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. And how has that been? Have you found that you've gotten a lot of support from people when you talk to the media? How has your people in your own networks reacted to the class action?
Well, I got a lot of compliments and congratulations on it, and I got a lot of people on my back.
Cool. Amazing. Yeah.
Yes, we're hearing a lot of good thing in the media first, which is, to me, very important, and for Arlene too, to change the... how people see the people that are being incarcerated. I think it's showing a human that it's a human that is incarcerated and not only a person that committed a crime. And we're happy how the media took the news. And also we received a lot of testimony about how it is courageous from Arlene to take that case and also how important for justice it is, either from lawyers or a lot of siblings of people that are into the hole now or have been into the hole or directly from ex prisoners that are happy that this practice is being denounced mm-hmm. publicly.
So I know that there's one other class action against Correctional Services Canada that's currently happening in Ontario, also about solitary confinement. Can either of you talk about why class actions are being brought forward in the provincial court system? Maybe that's more of a Clara question.
Well, actually, class action are more usually brought before provincial court, even if the defender is a federal entity. Federal courts, it's possible to brought a class action before federal courts, but it's less done. Because the Superior Court is able to hear the case, we used to do it before Superior Court in Quebec and in Ontario. And it will follow the usual court system. So Superior Court, then if there is an appeal, it's the Court of Appeal, and then Supreme Court. And it goes the same way in Ontario.
Okay. Cherchez-vous d'autres personnes pour l'action collective, and how could people get implicated if they want to be involved?
Donc, pour un recours collectif, pour être membre, il n'y a pas besoin de faire aucune action. Ça, c'est le cas partout au Canada. On est membre du groupe à partir du moment où on correspond à la définition. Dans notre cas, la définition, c'est d'avoir été en isolement dans les 3 dernières années pour plus que 72 heures ou d'avoir été en isolement dans les 3 dernières années alors qu'on souffrait d'un trouble de santé mentale. Donc, à partir du moment où la personne incarcérée match avec cette définition, elle fait partie du groupe, elle n'a pas besoin d'agir. La seule chose, c'est que pour garder contact avec les membres du groupe, on demande, dans la mesure du possible, aux membres du groupe de s'inscrire sur notre liste de membres, et ça nous permet de tenir au courant les membres du groupe quand il y a des nouvelles, par exemple, à l'issue du recours collectif, quand c'est positif ou négatif. Donc, un moyen de s'inscrire, c'est sur notre site Internet, donc www.tjl.com. Ou en appelant au téléphone 514-871-8385 et poste 210. Donc là, les gens peuvent s'inscrire et ça nous permet de garder contact, que ce soit un détenu ou quelqu'un de proche qui sait que le détenu ne peut pas s'inscrire lui-même. Ça nous permet, c'est ça, de tenir au courant. Puis c'est important parce que parfois, les personnes ne seront plus dans les institutions quand le recours va être gagné, s'il est gagné dans plusieurs années. Donc, to keep track of people, it's really important to subscribe to the newsletter or the class action.
Okay. Do you want to talk a little bit more about your experiences? I have a few more questions if you feel like talking about it.
Okay.
Okay. I'm curious, if you're in the hole in a federal institution in Quebec, can you get mail from your family, or are there restrictions in terms of the mail that you can receive?
The mail system, when in the federal penitentiary, well, from what I know in Joliet, when you're in the hole, it depends what you're in there for, if you get your mail, if you get your canteen, if you get this, if you get that. But every time I was waiting on mail, I would have to wait until I got out to get my mail, which is not fair.
Mm-hmm. So it's like you're stuck in the hole and you can't even be in contact with your family and stuff.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Because you don't have access to phone calls either.
Well, you do once a day.
Okay.
But it's hard to even ask for anything in there because they don't want to have nothing to do with you.
Mm-hmm. Trying to think. I had one other question for you. What was the longest stretch that you were stuck in the hole at one time?
I did 9 months in total, but okay. 3, 3, 3.
Okay.
So, but it's the same.
Yeah. Okay. And was the transition hard, when you would get out of the hole to transition back into being in, general population?
I never got transitioned into general population. I always got transitioned into the community.
Okay.
Which made no sense.
Okay.
And that was hard because I would be... the transportation from the hole to the community is weird.
Mm-hmm.
It was weird. It felt weird. I came out from being... locked up in a room with no sunlight or anything, and then going out on the street. It was weird.
Yeah, sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of the class action, how much time do you two think it will take before a judgment is made on the whole thing?
This is very difficult to say, but talking with statistics, let's say, normally after a judgment and authorization, we can hope to have a trial within 2-3 years. But yeah, it takes a long time. It's because we have to do the discovery, so get into all the papers of the defendant, so the CSE, they have to get into our papers. There are examination out of court, so this is the usual process. And then because of normal judicial delays, when you're ready to go to trial, you can wait a year, year and a half to have your trial be heard by a court. So it can take long, but I think we want to change things rapidly, so we do as fast as we can.
Is there anything else that either of you would like to share? I don't have any more questions for you guys.
No, I'm okay.
Okay.
Maybe I would just say that as lawyer, we want to hear stories of what happened in the whole. Each story is unique, of course.
It counts. Yeah.
Yeah. And each story counts, yeah. And but it's important for us to hear the stories to understand what is common between the stories. Mm-hmm. So if I can say again, subscribe to our class action on www.tjl.com or by making a call at 514-871-8385, extension 210. And we'll be happy to hear your stories and subscribe you as a member.
Okay. We've been speaking with Arlene Gallon and Clara Poisson-L'Espérance. Arlene is leading a class action lawsuit against the Correctional Services Canada for placing her in long-term solitary confinement during her imprisonment in the Women's Federal Prison in Joliet, Quebec, and Clara is her lawyer. Folks looking for more information about the lawsuit are welcome to also contact us. We'll be airing our mailing address at the end of the hour, and so if anyone is looking for definitions or anything like that and you haven't been able to get in touch with Clara, you can get in touch with us and we'll put you in touch with her. The time is presently 11:22, and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable. On cable, yeah, totally on cable. And www.ckut.ca. We're going to take a break.
Well, actually, up next, we have an interview we recorded with Muti A. Ajumu Osagboro. Muti is the founder and director of Juveniles RS, a human rights child advocacy organization, which mainly focuses on children who are innocent but have been falsely imprisoned. Muti himself was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole as a juvenile. His story was featured on a Prison Radio Show documentary about teenagers sentenced to life without the possibility of parole in 2012.
Okay, here we go. Bada bing, bada boom. Death by incarceration. Montgomery versus Louisiana and children who are innocent. Juveniles, no. We are children. This is the hallmark of Juveniles R Us, which I founded and direct. The word juvenile in North America is a court system sophistic white supremacist euphemism for nigger child. Not only does it brand black children not children, but it robs us and those of color of all the sympathies, sensitivities, and sensibilities associated with childhood. All the social, political, legal, intellectual, cultural protections and safeties reserved for matters dealing with children. It's the American judicial system's way of avoiding the authority of international law concerning the treatment of a child. The rights of a child is recognized globally by bodies like the United Nations, but a juvenile, quote unquote, is not. The former is clearly identified, while the latter remains buried and hidden in North American legal immorality. My name is Muti Ajumu Osagboro, and Junior Us is a human rights child advocacy organization which mainly focuses on children who are innocent but have been falsely imprisoned. Not only am I a member, but also a client. As a child, I was convicted for a crime, being an alleged lookout in a homicide robbery I did not commit.
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Rockview.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
I did not commit and sentenced to death by incarceration in spite of the fact that I am actually innocent with the evidence to prove it. This analysis is to address the United States Supreme Court's recent Montgomery versus Louisiana decision, not just on how it relates to the guilty seeking equity, but also to spark a national and international dialogue and movement on how it affects those of us who are actually innocent. A subject no so-called leader, child advocate, or attorney will dare to even whisper. Statewide and nationally, and especially here in Philadelphia, the cradle of hypocrisy and injustice, often touted beyond the borders of these United States as democracy and justice. It is nothing short of disgraceful how cruelly quiet these purported leaders are on this conscious, shocking American ordeal. In response to the comments made by Professor Julia Hall in the Juvenile Lifer Newsletter, issue number 58, concerning Montgomery, though Dr. Hall's integrity is without question, and she is one of the very few true child advocates, her assessment on what the high court's decision means misses the mark. Context is always the linchpin to understanding any issue. She wrote, quote, "A state may remedy a Miller violation by extending parole eligibility."
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Rockview.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
"By extending parole eligibility to juvenile offenders rather than resentencing them," end quote. Dr. Hall's quote of this portion of the court's opinion is irrelevant. Here's why. This is what is called dicta, more specifically, obiter dictum, Latin, meaning something said in passing. That is, a judicial comment made while delivering a judicial opinion, but on that necessary or unnecessary to the decision in the case, and not precedent. This is because the Montgomery case, the court only asked the answer in two questions. One, does it have jurisdiction? Which it answered, yes. Two, is it Miller holding 2012 retroactive? A resounding yes was the reply. Thusly, we now go back to the Miller case in order to get instructions as exactly what to do. Miller is the blueprint, not Montgomery. Montgomery's sole purpose was only to answer the two above questions before the court. Miller made it very clear that each of the 500 plus litigants in what I call Pennsylvania must have, at a minimum, a resentencing hearing, and that resentencing hearing must be by a judge or possibly jury, not by the Pennsylvania General Assembly, Pennsylvania GA. If the state legislature tries to usurp the high court's Miller's instruction, it will be in violation of both the 14th Amendment's due process of law and equal protections clause, as well as the separation of powers. Though Judge, not Justice, Antonin Scalia filed a lengthy dissent in the Montgomery case, he is an even more staunch opponent against the violation of separation of powers. The legislature cannot alter or overturn a judicially imposed sentence, nor can the legislature encroach upon the province of the judiciary. Conversely, the judiciary cannot tread on the grounds of the Pennsylvania General Assembly by legislating from the bench. Pennsylvanians, mark my words, prosecutors, closet prosecutors, so-called defense attorneys, and politicians, that is PCP, are going to team up and try every underhanded thing they can to make the court's dictum reality, thereby arrogating both the spirit and letter of the law in the Montgomery decision. We, juveniles or us, will not stand for it. Please get a copy of our next newsletter, Child Proof, to keep abreast of this freedom fight, lest we forget that this incestuous trio, PCP, has been trying to undermine the fight since 2005, when we drew on the irrefutable science that Roper, that is Roper versus Simmons, case revealed concerning the disadvantaged brain function of children. Be mindful that this decision applies to the entire country, especially but not limited to Michigan, California, Florida, and of course, Louisiana. Lastly, I now challenge you and all your journalist colleagues in the justice or law to broaden your focus to now include and speak out for those children, not juveniles, who are actually innocent with the evidence to prove it. Think about the glaring fact that here in Philly, the global capital of sentencing children to death by incarceration, not a single media outlet nor so-called child advocate, attorney, or leader has ever mentioned the words convicted innocent child in the same breath. In the bowels of the Terror Dome, this is Mufti Ajumur Saberu, a child live from America's other death row.
And that was Mufti Ajumur Saberu, who has been an advocate from within prison for folks like him who are sentenced to life without the possibility of parole as juveniles. This segment is part of what we hope will become a regular segment from Mufti, focusing on changes to the laws regarding sentencing children to life without the possibility of parole in the United States. We're now going to hear a song by Nina Simone. Here's the Work song. It's part of the soundtrack from the movie The 13th.
Breaking rocks out here on the chain gang. Breaking rocks and serving my time. Breaking rocks out here on the chain gang. Cause they done convicted me of crime. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terribly far to go. I committed crime, Lord, I need it. Crime of being hungry and poor. I left the grocery store, man, breathing. When they caught me robbing a store. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terribly far to go. I heard the judge say 5 years on the chain gang you gonna go. I heard the judge say 5 years of labor. I heard my old man scream, Lordy, no. Hold it right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terribly far to go. See my sweet honey babe, I'm gonna break this chain off the rung. I'm gonna lay down somewhere shady. Lord, I sure am hot in the sun. Hold it right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working.
Up next, we have Kim Pate live with us on the phone. Kim has been the director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies and was recently appointed to the Canadian Senate. Hi, Kim, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, definitely. Welcome back to the Prison Radio Show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My first question is, what does being appointed to the Senate mean for you? Will you still be working with EFRI and with the University of Ottawa while working with the Senate?
Well, I'm still involved with students, yes. The course that I was going to be teaching had to be canceled in part because of my schedule and in part because of their funding situation, because, as you probably recall, the monies from that course went to the education fund that's with the Elizabeth Fry Society. So that's unfortunate, but I still will have three or four students working, doing directed research and papers with me, so that's great. In terms of EFRI, I resigned as the paid position as soon as I was called about the Senate appointment, but I continue on as a volunteer with them, and there's an interim executive director, and there's the president has certainly taken on many of the duties of course, our regional advocacy team still do an incredible job going into the prisons and doing all of that work. And I've been in the prisons for the prisons since I was appointed, and certainly my plan is to continue to do the work, but in this new capacity.
Okay. That leads us into my second question, which is, do you think that being on the Senate will change the kind of advocacy work that you're able to do? And if so, how? It sounds like you're definitely still going inside, but will anything else change?
Well, the biggest change with respect to prisons is that I can no longer be kicked out. By the legislation, the Corrections and Conditional Release Act gives a right of access to judges, members of parliament, and senators. And so that's something that's very positive in terms of the future for my role in terms of the advocacy work within this capacity. The other piece is that, in terms of the law reform work and the work to actually develop decarceration strategies, I think there will be huge opportunities that while I may have had opportunities to be involved with previously, I'm only just beginning to figure out what I can be doing here. And I, my plan is for the 18 years, unless I, drop dead before then, that I'll have to do the work here. I hope to see a significant change in both how we deal with substantive inequality and, more to the point, how we promote substantive equality in this country, how we actually start to stem the tide of poor people, racialized people, anybody into the prison system, and how we actually breathe life into the parts of our charter that have literally been left to wither. They haven't died, but they've been left to wither and not, haven't seen growth. So those are some of the things that I'm my plan is to work on and to try and so far the response from the people who are here with me has been incredibly positive. And so I wasn't sure what to expect, I must confess. I've always had a good reception at hearings before the Senate committees, but you never know until you're in a place what it's going to be like. And so far, there's a lot I don't know yet, and I'm trying to learn as quickly as I can. But what I do know is that the reception has been positive, and many, many senators have said they think we should be going into the prisons and seeing what's happening, particularly given what's happened over the past 20 years in terms of changes to legislation that have resulted in more and more people being criminalized and imprisoned, and fewer opportunities for people in the community.
Mm-hmm. So in February of 2016, prisoners and their allies in a federal prison in Quebec released a list of demands to the Trudeau government. The document was titled Demand Prisons Change. I was wondering if you've seen it, and then I have a bunch of questions, or a few questions, like about the document itself, in case you haven't seen it.
I'm not sure I have seen that. I know of some other documents, but I don't know that I've seen that. I would like to see that, and I think it would be very relevant to some of the work that I'm hoping we're about to do.
Okay, great. Well, in the letter, folks are demanding a wide range of things, such as a pay rate in prison equal to the provincial minimum wage in which the prison, provincial minimum wage in which the prison is located, a reduction in the wait times for all programming, but especially for lifers and folks with long-term sentences. They're demanding access to better, fresher food inside, access to trained professionals for palliative care and personal care assistance, access to alternatives to re-imprisonment for parole violations, and a reinstatement of family days. I'm curious what you think of these kinds of demands and if they echo the kinds of issues that have been facing folks you've been talking to who've been inside.
Well, I would certainly support those and much more, quite frankly. I think that much of what I'm going to try and focus on is not just improving prisons, because my observation over 35 years of working with youth, men and women, is that the more we have tried to alleviate the most brutalizing conditions, the unintended consequence of that is that prisons don't look so bad sometimes to those outside, whether it's judges or lawyers or, you know, both defense counsel and Crown, and individuals themselves who are facing custody. And I think, so of course, I'd be supportive of alleviating those conditions in the short term, but long term, I really want to see us really question the use of imprisonment, period. And you know, it was in the mid-90s that all the heads of correction said that we could reduce the numbers of people in prison and not increase the risk to public safety. I think we need to, you know, hold people to account on those kinds of comments and those kinds of realities. I mean, there's tons of research to show that. There's tons of evidence. We know that it's not the people who are have the greatest privilege who end up in prison. And so let's get people out. Let's prevent people from going there.
Mm-hmm. So you've talked about decarceration strategies, and you were talking a bit about that in this last answer. I know you've also spoken in the past about prison abolition, like abolishing prisons completely as another long-term goal potentially. Is there a difference for you between decarceration and like abolition of the prison industrial complex, and what do you see the difference as?
Well, I see decarceration as part of the incremental move towards abolition, quite frankly. And so, you know, we've had countless recommendations from all kinds of bodies, whether it's the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the inquest jurors who looked into the death of Ashley Smith, even the mandate letters from the Prime Minister to the Ministers of Justice and Public Safety talked about reducing the numbers. So I see them, it is part of that overall strategy. The other part that you know, that is part of the overarching picture in terms of some of the immediate things that I think can be done to help stem the tide is to implement at the very least the bill that Erwin Kotler had proposed to allow judges to go around mandatory minimum, to use their discretion to not apply mandatory minimum sentences in situations where they shouldn't be applied. I mean, I would argue repeal them all, but given that there appears not to be a huge appetite to do that, one of the ways to achieve this, you know, almost the same goal is to implement that kind of legislation. And I have indicated to a number of folks, and will be meeting with ministers, I hope, in the future, to speak directly with them about it, and indicating that if the government is willing to bring forward a bill like that, I would be happy to support it. And if not, then I'll be looking at probably a Senate a bill that I sponsor in the Senate to start that discussion. In addition, not just bringing back pardons, but having a scheme that is an automatic pardon process, so that people are not having to go through the cost and the bureaucracy of applying for pardons in situations where it's clear they should have a pardon, and they I would be recommending no more than a 5-year waiting period for that. And for individuals who, for employment reasons or other reasons, may want to apply earlier or may, you know, want to apply after a youth record, to be able to apply sooner than that and invoke that process. I've also suggested that we look at getting rid of segregation as a starting point on that incremental move, and some legislation around that. So those are some immediate pieces that I think we could be doing fairly easily. In addition, the existing legislation allows for ways to get people out of prison right now. Section 29 for people with mental health or other kinds of health issues, and sections 81 and 84 for Indigenous prisoners, but also other prisoners. It's not just Indigenous prisoners it applies to. And so communities could be saying, I want to sponsor someone back into the community to serve their sentence, not just on parole, but to serve their sentence. And the law right now allows that, but has not been used except to build mini institutions in a couple of rare circumstances. And I think we should be looking at much more creative options to actually get people out and into the community so that they can be thriving in the community and not, you know, dying inside.
That's all for my questions. Did you have anything you wanted to add, Kim?
No, thank you very much for doing this, and okay. And thank you so much for the continued work you do. I mean, you help to ensure that mainstream media stays on this, and you do a fantastic job of ensuring that people know what's happening in the prisons. And
I am one of many who's incredibly appreciative.
Thanks. And for folks who haven't seen, demandprisonschange.wordpress.com is where you can see the list of demands that I referenced, written by some people in federal prison in Quebec and their allies. We were just speaking on the phone with Kim Pate, the executive director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies and a newly appointed Canadian senator. She actually told us just now in the interview that she is now a volunteer with the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies. We were talking about her appointment to the Senate and some of her plans around decarceration and prison abolition. We also talked about the Demand Prisons Change document, which I just mentioned again. Their website is demandprisonschange.wordpress.com, and we'll post a link to it on our blog. We're going to do a few more news items for you.
But first, we're going to hear a song by The Roots. Here is Criminal on the Prison Radio Show on CQT 90.3 FM.
Because of what it was, I did what I did, cause it does what it does. I don't put nothing above what I am, what I love. My family, my blood, my city and my hood. Hater for the greater good. I'm back from Hollywood and I ain't changed a lick. Though I know I probably should, but what I'm doing is not a good look. I never did it by the good book. As a lifetime crook, all the petty crime took a toll on me. I look around at my homies, it's getting old on me. But still something got a hold on me, maybe it's fake. If it's coming, yo, I'm willing to wait. I'm not running, I don't ran through the muck. I done scrambled and such. I done robbed and odd jobs and gambled enough. Till I'm put up in handcuffs and pissing in the cup. If it's a guy, I don't know if he listening or what.
And that's how it go. Get treated like a criminal if crime is all you know. Get greeted like a nigga if the niggas all you show. A public enemy to send an eye in the scope. My city like an island where you can't find a boat. And you wishing for a raft and praying that hope flows. Surreal ethnic cleansing going down no soap. Who looking for a chair and some real strong rope just to end it all here? Screaming fuck the mayor. You see the faces at the bottom of the well clear. They act like I'm something to fear. Trapped in urban warfare, pulling triggers at a college career. Can't ignore the call of the wilders drawing them near. Tried to make fast money last, lost some years. Tried to laugh it off, still couldn't lose the tears. To the rules I will not adhere. Break the law, yeah.
Challenge mine. I'm sick of St. Valentine. I did the violent crimes, why I got the style of rhyme. Seek repentance for spitting them sentences to senseless. Experienced the difference, you can't convince this. In a crime sense, niggas is infants. I'm like a senior citizen, still living for getting benefits. Put emphasis on hitting my nemesis in high percentages. Crooked ass cops is the reason for my belligerence. And it gets deeper than that. Remember nights I used to sleep with a gat. With the package of crack under my sneakers strap. These sneak attack, it rained me, it took a week for that. Beat the rat, put you saying, look, he think he the man. Fuck y'all, niggas who thinkin' they might try us. Watch us in sight rise, flip cars and light fires. We already been knocked, scrutinized plus. Cops rush to brutalize us. America's polluted by lust. Who could I trust? If I can't trust you, then I might touch you. If I ain't got love for you, then fuck you.
Dream.
And that was The Roots with Criminal, and you are still listening to the Prison Radio Show here on SKUT 90.3 FM. We have a few more news items for you to close out the show this week. First of all, the United States government announced last Tuesday the release of Oscar Lopez Rivera, who had been imprisoned in the United States for 36 years for his struggle to free Puerto Rico from U.S. colonial rule. Former U.S. President Barack Obama commuted Lopez's sentence, along with many others, but especially following the receipt of 10,000 letters to the White House demanding Rivera's release. Lopez was born in Puerto Rico in 1943 and is an independence leader in his native country. Upon returning to Chicago, after serving in the Vietnam War, he joined the struggle for the rights of the Puerto Rican people and participated in acts of civil disobedience and other actions. In 1976, he joined the clandestine fight for the independence of Puerto Rico as a member of the Armed Forces of National Liberation. In 1981, he was captured by the FBI, accused of conspiracy for his militancy in the FALN. At the time of his capture, he proclaimed himself as a prisoner of war, protected in the first protocol of the Geneva Convention of 1949. So therefore, the protocol protected Lopez for being a person arrested in conflict against colonial occupation. The U.S. did not recognize the demand of Lopez and sentenced him to 55 years in prison. After an alleged attempt to escape, the sentence increased to 70 years in prison, 12 of which have been spent in solitary confinement. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton in 1999 offered him a pardon. The offer was made to 13 members who accepted, but Lopez rejected it because it included completing 10 years in jail with good behavior. Leaders from around the world, as well as human rights organizations, have demanded the release of Oscar Lopez Rivera. On June 18, 2012, the UN Decolonization Committee approved a resolution promoted by Cuba in which it called for recognition of Puerto Rico's right to independence and self-determination and urged the release of the pro-independence detainees in the United States. And so Lopez Rivera will be free on May 17, 2017, and is already planning a tour to talk about his experiences.
A nationwide coalition of nursing associations comprised of the Association of Registered Nurses of British Columbia, the Canadian Association of Nurses in HIV/AIDS Care, the Canadian Nurses Association, and the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario have been granted intervener status in an application before the Superior Court of Justice of Ontario for clean needles and syringes to be made available in prisons. The Prison Needle Syringe Program Nursing Coalition will present a nursing perspective in the lawsuit filed by four HIV/AIDS agencies and a former inmate who contracted hepatitis C during his incarceration. It is against the Minister of Public Safety, Correctional Services Canada, the Commissioner of CSC, and the Attorney General of Canada. The lawsuit challenges the constitutionality of the decision to treat clean needles and syringes as contraband and seeks an order that will bring clean needle exchange programs to the federal prisons. The United Nations Basic Principle for the Treatment of Prisoners asserts that people in correctional facilities should have access to health services available in the country without discrimination. Yet while clean needle and syringe programs exist across the country, they are not accessible in Canadian prisons, where addiction is far more prevalent. The coalition will argue that laws preventing harm reduction programs in prisons pose a threat to the health of inmates who inject drugs and obstruct nurses from fulfilling their legal and ethical obligation to provide essential health services. Nurses are the largest healthcare presence in the country's prisons and are often prisoners' first point of contact when they need healthcare. Our next news item comes to you from Chaz Ransom, who is currently imprisoned in Otisville Medium State Prison in New York State. He has a news item for especially folks in prison in New York State, which reads, on January 20th, 2017, the New York State Parole Board filed new rules for operation with the Secretary of State. The additions include special consideration of, number one, the diminished capacity of youth, and two, growth and maturity since the time of the committed offense. This is in accordance with the United States Supreme Court jurisprudence decision in Montgomery v. Louisiana, 2016. Also, the COMPAS, which stands for Correctional Offender Management Profiling Alternative Sanction, a risk and needs assessment which evaluates risk to public safety, was viewed as another factor to be merely considered in granting parole. Now statutory language makes the COMPAS an evaluatory document to be weighed. If the parole board deviates from the compass to contravene the findings, they must articulate in detailed and non-conclusory terms their reasoning for administrative and judicial review. The new information is available to everyone in their facility law library. These changes come as the result of the concerted efforts of a coalition of organizations, both categories of organizations of incarcerated persons and community-based organizations. These organizations all focus on the parole board's abuse of discretion. The New York State Division of Parole can no longer continue to abuse their discretion to deny parole to community-ready individuals at the expense of taxpayers. Such deliberate abuse of discretion undermines the process of rehabilitation and public safety. A recent editorial in the New York Times editorial/letters titled False Hope and a Needless Death Behind Bars on Tuesday, September 6, 2016 emphasizes this point. There have been a bunch of other news articles in the last few months, including in the Village Voice and a few more articles in the New York Times that folks are encouraged to check out. And this news item ends by encouraging everyone to have their families call the governor to demand that he make the parole board process more transparent and accountable by providing written transcripts of the deliberation process for release consideration. This will help to provide a fair and impartial interview and review for all eligible applicants for parole release. Also, that folks ask about the investigation into the racial bias ad abuses. Please don't let the exposure on this serious matter fade. Thank you and God bless. The governor can be reached in Albany at 518-474-8390, or you can email him. The website is nys.gov. Please register your complaint to stop this abuse of discretionary authority that destroys families and communities. Signed, Chaz Ransom, who is the president of the Lifers and Long-Termers Organization at Otisville Medium State Prison. We will also post Chaz's message on our website in case you missed it. And this is the Prison Radio Show on CKUT. It's currently 11:56. Do we want to outro the show or do we want to play a song? Outro the show, yeah. So check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Prison Radio Show. Our show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m. Our next show is going to air on Thursday, February 9th at 5 p.m. If you have any questions about anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, you can contact us. prison@ckut.ca is our email address. We especially encourage formerly incarcerated people to participate. Folks can leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. Or you can write to us. We're at Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Virginia.
And my name is Candace.
And we've been your hosts for today. Please stay tuned.